I agree entirely, and I think there's another parallel to the wrestling and even football mentality, is that you need to be present in what you're doing at that time. So every practice, every match, that is the most important practice and match. And we take that approach at Growing Circle of O'Neill as well, in that every case is the most important case, because that's all that matters at that time, and our clients can't come back for another shot.
What really happens behind the scene of a personal injury case when it goes to trial? I'm your host, Mike Sale. On this episode of The Injury Pros, we're joined by a heavyweight in the courtroom, Franklin Strokoff, to break down the truth and philosophy behind litigation and the tactics insurance companies take, and how choosing the right or wrong lawyer can impact you and your case. Franklin is a founding partner at Groen, Strokoff, and O'Neill, and has earned national recognition for his multi-million dollar verdicts and deep courtroom experience. Let's jump right in.
Franklin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
We've known each other for, what, about 15 years?
I think so.
And introduced by a consensual friend, I guess, right?
That's fair.
And you're a personal injury lawyer in Philadelphia, right?
I am.
When I first met you, you were working for another firm, right? It was kind of a more of an advertising, bigger firm, right? Doing all the trial work, right?
Right.
But before you became a lawyer, can you tell us a little bit about your upbringing?
Sure. I grew up outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in a small town, Camp Hill. I was involved in anything athletic or physical that I could be, from football to baseball, wrestling, track and field, rugby. Upon graduation from high school, I went to Albright College, where I played football for 4 years. After Albright, I went to Delaware Law School, where I played rugby. And then I went and did insurance defense work for a decade.
Insurance defense, yeah.
I did, yeah.
Oh, wow. For a decade?
For a decade, yeah.
Oh, wow. That was before I met you.
It was. Wow. Right before.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Okay, so how was Albright?
Albright was a great time. It's a small liberal arts school, about 2,000 students. Everybody knows everybody. And being on the football team there, of the 1,000 males, 100 of us played football. Okay. So needless to say, anywhere you went, you ran into a teammate and a friend.
That's cool.
And it was a great time. It was very supportive, got a good education, and had a lot of fun.
So it sounds like you did multiple sports in high school.
I did.
Not like today. These kids are specializing in one or two sports. Max,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we deal with that all the time. I'm a firm proponent of do as many things as you can for as long as you can.
Gotcha. And one of the things that we share was wrestling.
Yes.
Right? We both wrestled in high school.
Right.
Did not in college, but I feel like we both took away a lot of the, you know, values and determination, hard work from wrestling, which probably made us into who we are today. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that I probably learned more from wrestling than I did any other sport. I chose in college to play football because it was more my passion. But, you know, the lessons learned through wrestling are probably far superior than football.
They say wrestling's harder than football. Is that true?
Absolutely.
But all football players should wrestle because it's great for football.
Absolutely. When I looked across our locker room in college, there were a lot of guys who wrestled in high school that played football in college because a lot of the things translate. Probably most significantly is that it's all on you in wrestling, as you know. There's no finger pointing.
No excuses.
There's no excuses. There's no blaming. It's purely up to you.
Although my little one loves to blame the ref. Tell him you're blind, yeah. You need glasses. Yeah. But I always tell them, you left it up to one or two points, that's on you.
That's exactly right.
If you leave it up to the ref, you know, if he makes a bad, everyone's human.
Right.
Sometimes they're really bad refs. You know, we get angry as coaches, and they never want to hear from us trying to change the score. But he gets angry sometimes, and I try to teach him that lesson that you left it that close. And you can't depend on other people to get where you want to be. You know,
sure.
This is on you. You got to drive your own ship here.
Yeah.
So hopefully he learns those lessons. He's 12 now, and we'll see where he's going. He just started middle school.
I have a 12-year-old daughter who just started middle school as well.
Yeah.
She's a soccer player and lacrosse player, and we teach her those same lessons. That, you know, a lot of times it's just not fair. You know, life
no,
isn't fair,
and so. That's life. Yeah, that's why. Like,
that's okay.
That's why we love, I think we both love wrestling, is because the losses teach you more than the wins.
Absolutely.
And I think that what gave me the determination and the grit, I would call it, to even get through law school. Like, you went to Delaware, you said, right?
I did, yeah.
So wasn't Widener anymore?
It was Widener at the time. It's not
okay.
Delaware.
Yeah. So I went to Widener, too.
Oh, very nice.
And I just remember, like, studying First year was the toughest, I thought.
Agreed.
And then second and third year, I worked and went to school. But I remember studying for the bar, you know, going to those classes. And it was like 4 hours a day. Then you would study at home for 4 to 5 hours a day, try to break it up, go to the gym. But I just remember looking back at my high school wrestling days and how hard those practices were and the confidence that I built from working hard and continuing that effort helped me study, continue to study, learn, and make it all the way through. And then pass the bar with flying colors, of course, because I know I never want to take it again.
Of course.
Yeah. Of course. So did you have that kind of same feeling or experience with your sports background when you were going through the hard parts of law school and the bar exam?
Absolutely. And I think I carry that today as well. If I have, you know, a trial that I'm preparing for and I'm up at 6 a.m., you know, reading through briefs and up until midnight doing the same thing, I remember this isn't that hard. I mean, it is. But you reflect back on the times when you were in a 105-degree wrestling room for 3 hours after running a mountain. and it puts things in perspective. And I think wrestling teaches you that you can go beyond what you expect you can. Yep. And I think that you carry that into, in particular, this line of work, where preparedness is everything.
Definitely this line of work. Because, look, no matter how many cases, if you try cases, you're going to lose cases.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's very hard mentally and emotionally after a loss when you put all of your effort, all of your experience, all of your time into, and you dedicated to that case and that client, and you liked the client, and you cared about the client, and you wanted the best for the client, and for some reason, 12 strangers decided a different point and decided not to find, you know, the other person at fault, or just did not return as much money as you want. So we suffer losses in this business, and they're not real losses, because sometimes we do have recoveries, but we always want to get more because that's our job.
Right.
But it's tough, and I think our background in sports, and especially wrestling, because it's just on you, when you lose, we have that experience losing and then coming back because we have more cases, right? We have many, many cases as lawyers. Problem is, for that client, it's their only shot. That's their one shot.
Right.
So us trial lawyers, we have to, you know, we got to give it our all. And I think you do it and your firm does. And we pride our firm on pushing every case. And that's, you know, one thing that my partner John and I, we found things in common together is like one thing, once we're in on a case, we're like a dog. We work that thing. We spend nights, weekends, whatever it is, to devote to that case to give it. Because that's like our only case at that time.
Right.
And it's the client's only case. And we feel it's our ethical duty, moral duty, to do our best.
I agree entirely. And I think there's another parallel to the wrestling and even football mentality is that you need to be present in what you're doing at that time. Yeah. So every practice, every match, that is the most important practice and match. And we take that approach at Growing Circle of O'Neill as well, in that every case is the most important case. Because that's all that matters at that time. And our clients can't come back for another shot.
No.
So we make sure that we give them everything that is humanly possible to get a favorable result.
Yeah.
And if it's unfortunate that it doesn't happen, we know that there's nothing else we could have done.
Yeah. I tell my clients, even when I sign up with them, I promise to do my best. And I can't tell you what's going to happen. I can't tell you how much the insurance company is going to final offer, especially on a bigger case.
Right.
Where there's a lot of insurance, but all I could do is I will fight to the end and I'll promise to do my best. And 99.9% of clients are just so happy to hear that someone's going to fight for them and promise to give them their best.
Yeah, and I think that's something that both of our firms have in common is that clients come to our firms because they want that assurance from the person who's actually going to be working on the file.
Yep.
And I think that when you have a boutique shop like your firm and our firm, they had that reassurance that when you come with a big case to me or to you, we're the ones who are going to be handling it. You're not going to be shuffled around 15 different people, 15 different lawyers. You're going to have us, and you're going to build that trust with us from the beginning. And a lot of times I think that's actually the difference because you can get information from your clients that, you know, become your teammates through trust that ordinarily a lot of lawyers wouldn't get because they don't take the time to listen and to learn about the person. Yeah. And the case itself.
And some clients are easy to go along with. Some clients are more difficult in my experience. But, you know, we're all come from different places. But at the same time, they're going through a life-changing event that we always have to keep perspective on. A lot of lawyers just say, that client's a pain in the butt. I don't want to deal with him or her. But we're all people. So we all have a common thread and a background. And sometimes we have to be the bigger person, understand where they're coming from, what kind of pain they're in, what in their background makes them this way, and how can I best communicate with them and get them to trust us so that they listen to us, they do what they're supposed to do, they get the treatment they're supposed to do, and they prepare themselves for things like depositions.
Right. Yeah, I agree entirely.
So, all right, so let's step back a second. So you did defense work for 10 years.
I did.
Tell us about
what kind of
work was that?
I was doing insurance defense work, basically defending the kinds of claims that we now bring.
So what for our audience, what kind of cases?
Premises liability cases.
Break that down. What's a premise liability?
Slip and fall.
Okay.
Slip and fall. I would defend some trucking litigation for some crashes on the interstates, a lot of commercial properties involving different types of liability.
Gotcha.
It kind of ran the gamut for about 10 years.
How did you come into that job? I always wonder how defense attorneys, they get into that work. Like some people are prosecutors and look for their next job, whether they start their own business or go with a defense firm or some kind of other corporate firm. And then other people just start out on their own. But how did you get into being a defense lawyer first?
Sure. So when I was in law school, my father, who passed away a couple of years ago, was also a lawyer for many years in Harrisburg. And he always told me that he thought I should be in the courtroom. It's my personality. I love the competition.
Yeah.
And I love people. So when I was about to graduate law school, I said, I'm going to write a letter to some of the top plaintiffs' firms in the city and get my first job. And he gave great advice. He said, no, why don't you write a letter and seek out work through defense firms? Because if you learn the way that they operate and get the proper training the way that they defend cases, it's going to make you much more valuable on the other side. Yeah. He then made the analogy that kind of rang true to me. He said, when you're playing defensive line, isn't it beneficial that you also in high school played offensive line?
Yeah.
I said, absolutely. He said, because you could watch the way that the weight shifted to determine if it was a run or a pass. And I said, yes. He said, we'll use the same thing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say I went to start defense work with the intention of crossing over, but it was certainly in the back of my mind.
And you probably got some great experience because on the defense side, you're right into litigation right away, right?
Yes, I was doing depositions right away. I had a wonderful mentor who defended cases against some of the top plaintiffs' firms in the city.
Yeah.
So I was often in depositions watching the way that they would do things, and I really learned a lot.
Wow, that's some great advice from your father. What kind of lawyer was he?
He was an employment lawyer.
Employment lawyer. Okay. Well, when I was coming out of law school, everyone was saying, look, get your trial experience, get on your feet, because when you get older as a lawyer, you get very nervous, scared to go in the courtroom, don't know what to do, timid. So I started right out on a plaintiff's personal injury firm, and my boss at that time actually educated us, which was really helpful, and I was trying cases within the first 2 years and had 100 more cases assigned to me right away. So I took just a little different approach, but it's weird and strange how people coming out of law school, how their career develops, I feel, based on their first job and what their opportunity is. Because coming out of school, most students graduating and passing the bar, I don't think they know what they want to do yet. I don't think they have a career path in mind. They don't have mentors like your father. My father is a lawyer, too.
Right.
And you get your first job. Why? Because you need a job, right? You're coming out of school. You have loans. Everyone expects you to get a job. There's probably tons of people graduating, not as many jobs, and you did apply to all the big firms and all that stuff. And I remember getting rejected from all the big firms because, I was a BC student in college, mostly a B in accounting. It was really hard. We did whatever we could to get by in college. But in law school, I really applied myself. But going to Widener, since it was a newer school, we weren't like a top tier school.
Right.
So we were competing with people from Temple, Villanova, Penn, and Philly, some of the really good schools, and the bigger firms wanted those super old schools with, I was on the dean's list, which was good, but I just didn't make it to those big firms, and I'm thank God I didn't, but I kept all those letters, those denial letters, right? And I don't know what happened to them. I think there was a flood or something. They got all wet. But I figured someday, and I think I knew somebody who did this, that made wallpaper with all the denial letters.
Because
we're, you know, seem to be successful now at this point in our careers, and all those denial letters that nobody wanted us back then, but now we're successful.
It's very motivating. I remember going to the swearing-in ceremony after I passed the bar in City Hall in Philadelphia, and everybody there, not everybody there, 50% of the people there were very vocal about the big firm job they landed.
Yeah.
And they let us know about it.
Yeah.
And I always remembered who said what as well. And to your point, it was a great motivator. And when I look back and I see where
they are now,
some of them are now, I'm very grateful that it did not seek or get a big firm job.
It's funny you say that. And I have to give credit where credit's due to a smaller school like Widener, Delaware Law School. We're having our 50th anniversary coming up.
Yeah, saw that.
My dad was a second graduating class, he was able to stand on the table and hand me my diploma and wear one of those Burger King hats.
That's great.
It was a great experience for us. I think, you know, if you look at the judges and stuff, I'm not saying, you know, judges is the best position, being a judge is the most position, but it's a respected position in our field, being a judge, right?
Yep.
A lot of the trial lawyers and judges came from scrappy schools like Widener, as opposed to these big, you know, blue whatever schools they call them, like the Ivy League schools, you know. Those are the ones that work. The Ivy League guys are going into the bigger firms, probably making three times as we did coming out of school, but they're working 90 hours a week. They're working every weekend. They, you know, don't see their family.
Right.
And they end up being miserable. And that's why I think lawyers, you know, lawyers are not happy in general. You know, they're working for the man, they're working for the firm, they're working their life away. They're getting paid pretty well, but at the same time, at some point they realize that life's more important.
Right.
Experiencing life, being with your kids is more important than just, you know, working away to get that big salary.
Sure.
And then eventually guys like us who have a good business, we catch up with them and then eclipse them, and then we're just looking back and saying, we did it our way, right?
Right.
Like
absolutely.
Frank Sinatra, right?
So,
you know, looking back at my career, sure, there's things you could have done differently, you know, but there's just different levels. And yeah, work hard every day, try to get better, and just level up, get new experiences, meet new people, level up again. And I don't know about you, but like when I was in law school, I was just happy to be busy at a firm or eventually have my own firm. Now I have a firm probably three times the size I've ever thought I'd have.
Right.
And then, you know, your goals and successes become bigger and bigger. And that's just as a result of working hard. And
yeah,
I think it goes back to our roots.
I agree. And I think what I learned at Delaware Law Widener was relatability matters.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
In particular in what we do. And I remember meeting some trial lawyers while we were in law school and just thinking to myself, wow, that's a really good guy. I'd have a beer with that guy. And that kind of always resonated because I saw how successful they were.
Yeah.
And I think that's an advantage for guys like us going to Widener when we're on trial against guys from Harvard or Penn or anything.
They're so stiff at times.
I think we're much more relatable, and these juries don't want to feel patronized. They want to feel respected, and they want to trust the lawyers that are giving them the information, and I think that that's, you know, very valuable.
We're dealing with people.
Right.
Like we have to adapt. A good lawyer, in my philosophy is you have to adapt to every situation. If you want to get a result or if you want to advocate, you need to adapt. So if you have someone with a crazy personality or someone with a strong personality or someone who's laid back or judge those people, jurors don't get to talk that much because we have limited voir dire, even jury selection.
Right.
You know, so you have to adapt. If you want the result you're looking for your client or yourself or whatever position you are in life, you have to be able to adapt to that person in that situation, whether you're quiet for a while and listening or you're strong and, you know, control the room. And getting those people skills. You know, my partner John's very good at this because he was a politician growing up, and he always was with the people. You get to know the people, and having those people skills makes you more relatable, and eventually with a jury, I think, makes you more believable, trustworthy, and then that trustworthiness will rub off on your client, and then hopefully that will bring in a successful verdict.
I agree completely. Yeah. And you mentioned before about how, you know, each client comes from a different phase in their life. Yeah. And I think being able to identify that and relate to that again is so important. You know, growing up outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania is much different than the main line where I live now.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that I would not trade that upbringing for anything because I can relate to people from all walks of life.
Yep.
So that when I come across them as clients or as jurors, I now understand them. And it's my hope that, you know, throughout a trial, they understand me and that they trust me. And that leads to a favorable result as well.
Well, watching you, you know, I'm a couple years older than you, I think. Watching you and what since I've known you, like you were an inspiration to me because you had you actually went to the courtroom and got results.
I appreciate that.
Where most guys and girls are not afraid, but they're timid and they'll try to settle a case. Because I think in this business, and even in some other like criminal defense, you can always justify a settlement in your own brain or with the client. You can always sell a settlement if you want to and tell the client why you think you should settle. But it takes the stronger lawyers, the tougher lawyers, I'd say the most more experienced lawyers, but someone who's been through the fight to say no to a good offer.
Right.
Like, you know, a few years ago, I on a slip and fall case, I said no to $1.5 million offer. And that was probably one of the bigger offers I've ever walked away from. And thankfully, I had a good client that really wanted to push me too. But it takes some oomph and, you know, whatever they call it, you know, to really guide that client and push them when it needs to be pushed. Sometimes we can't, you know, we give settlement ranges, right, for a case if we get an offer, settlement range. But we can't guarantee what the jury's going to do.
Right.
You know, we like to think in Philly we get some pretty good juries, but out here you never know what's going to do, you know, out in the counties. But, you know, just to know when to push the client. And you have to have that confidence and that experience and that caring enough to say, you need a better life. And this offer might look good, but it's not what it should be.
Right.
And then to push that case to the end, especially on the bigger cases. And then if need be, if they're not ponying up that money, try the case.
Absolutely.
So.
And the defense firms also know whether or not you're willing to go through that fire.
Yeah.
And if they think you're not, then they're going to give you a lowball offer. They're never going to offer you full value.
And more now they're keeping track of us. We've talked about Absolutely. That on this podcast.
Yeah.
And now with AI, they're keeping track of every offer they make to an attorney.
Right.
What his or her response is, where they end up, do they file suit or not, how far do they go in litigation.
Right.
They have us measured out to the T. So when, you know, people are looking for lawyers, it's important that they know that lawyer's track record because the insurance companies know it. And more than ever, I believe, that really is going to affect the outcome of the case.
I agree. And I think you also need to know when you're choosing a law firm, which lawyer you're going to be working with. I think that in the world that we're in, you can call a phone number and be assigned to one of 500 different lawyers.
Yeah.
I think there's value in, especially in serious cases, of saying, you know what, I want to meet with you, and coming in and meeting with your lawyer and sitting down with them and seeing whether or not it's a good fit. Because when you are in those battles, those 2-3-4 year battles that end up at trial, you need to be able to rely upon the relationship that you've built.
That relationship's going to be tested.
Absolutely.
Tested. And just
over
like
and
a
over.
Just like a marriage, you know, if you can build that foundation where, you know, you trust, the trust foundation. You may have it out. The client may have it out with you.
Sure.
Something might go wrong. The client may do something silly that affects the case, and you're upset because you've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours and tens of thousands of dollars on the case. Or the client may be upset at you for some reason that you don't feel is justified. You have to be able to bring it back to the core, the foundation of trust,
right?
So that you guys can move on. And you know, obviously, we're fighting giants here. We're fighting huge insurance companies with unlimited assets, and you know, on some cases, very experienced defense attorneys that are teams of them that now have AI, that now have every technological advantage, which we're coming around to on our side too, to focus. And their only job is to minimize or eliminate the case, and our job is to maximize the case. And one lawyer kind of explained it to me once. It's like, and I tell this to doctors, it's like, you are, as a trial lawyer, you're doing an operation on a person, but the other doctor across the table from you is actually trying to screw up your operation.
Right.
And you're trying to get the best result in this operation and save this person's life, but you got some other doctor that's clipping this and clipping that, trying to screw it up. And that's what kind of what we have to go through.
Absolutely.
And hopefully we get fair judges and juries. But all right, let's talk about your new firm. And I call it new, but you've been around for how many years now?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
And what's the name of it?
Growing Strokoff O'Neill.
Okay. And Strokoff's your last name,
yes,
right? So you're a name partner there. And I know you were at another firm, another plaintiff's firm for a while.
Right.
And you kind of wanted to do your own thing. And we talked about that when that happened and maybe before it happened. And it took a while for you to make the jump.
Yes.
But what were your reasons and personal reasons, and what did you want to deliver and achieve by creating your own firm?
Sure. So the firm that I previously worked for was great to me. They're a great firm. They're great lawyers. They're great people. I'm still in contact with them almost daily.
Oh, wow.
So it was a great place
to
be. I think that's what made it hard for me to leave,
sure,
is that they treated me so well. But at the end of the day, I wanted to have the ability to be more selective in terms of what I handled personally, what I believed in personally. And I wanted to build out a firm that kind of shared my vision and shared my viewpoint of the world. And, you know, I was lucky enough to not come across, but to know both of my partners for decades.
Okay.
I went to law school with Justin Groen, who was a DA in Philadelphia, and then did some high-end plaintiff's work for many years. And then I actually did defense work with Fran O'Neill probably 15 years ago.
Okay.
They had met each other once before, I think as adversaries. I introduced them, reintroduced them over a beer 5 or 6 years ago, and it kind of just, you know, came to fruition that way.
Gotcha.
But it's been great. We just opened our second office in Conshohocken. We handle anything from the run-of-the-mill motor vehicle to products liability to medical malpractice. My focus is on catastrophic trucking and some construction and things of that nature. So, you know, we're trying to give it the boutique attention that our clients deserve, but also have the ability to run the gamut and handle everything.
Gotcha. So do you have any core values or anything that sets your firm apart?
Sure. Our core value is that we are all, the three named partners, we all have very close families. So our core value is to treat everyone like we treat our family.
Gotcha.
And it's also to understand that our clients have their own family, and that oftentimes the case is much bigger than that person. It's going to affect their children, their grandchildren, and probably great-grandchildren. So, you know, we kind of keep that in mind with the way we handle things.
Gotcha. So it's the three lawyers?
It's the three lawyers. We have another partner, Bill Koppel.
Okay.
We have another associate.
Okay.
We've got 5 on-site paralegals and 1 remote paralegal.
Gotcha. And you do what states?
We do Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York.
New York, too. Okay.
Yeah, New York, too. I'm born in New York. I do some work there. I wouldn't say I do a ton, but for the right case, we do handle New York.
Gotcha. So how do most people find your firm?
The majority of our cases come from word of mouth. You know, we do have a strong network of referring attorneys, but all of us come from different communities in or around Philadelphia. Yeah. We all have kids involved in sports and in school, and we really try to make sure that the community knows that if something really bad happens, they can come to us and get us. They're not going to be shifted off to somebody that they don't know.
Gotcha.
And we've done very well with that model.
Gotcha. Now, your team, I think I've met everyone, and I know Bill, and so I know you have a good team. Does your firm take cases all the way to trial?
We do. Okay. Yeah, we've tried, I want to say 5 or 6 in the last year to trial.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times some of the better cases, you know, don't go to trial.
Yep.
You know, I say cases are won in discovery. So if you have a case that you work up properly and the other side knows that you're willing to take it, oftentimes it will resolve.
Yeah.
But we will take cases that are not big cases of trial.
Yeah.
Because to your point, they keep tabs on us.
Yeah.
So we've got, you know, some younger lawyers who, if they have a small case, and I shouldn't say small, if they have a non-catastrophic case, because no case is small, in Bucks County, for example, and a lowball offer is made, we'll just say go try it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's oftentimes it won't be a favorable result, but, you know, the client is happy because
you fought for them.
We fought for them. They get their day in court. And we always tell our clients at the end of the day, we're okay if the jury tells us we're wrong.
Yeah.
But we're not going to accept an insurance company or a defense lawyer telling us we're wrong.
And most clients I found, when you have gone to trial with them and have spent the trial and gone through that whole emotional ride with them, a verdict is like a bonus. Them knowing that they had somebody to fight for them. They had their story told.
Right.
And a group of 12 strangers actually believe them because, you know, the client's going through the process. They get beat up, right?
Right.
Through the discovery process, you know, especially through depositions where the defense attorney can grill them about every possible thing that's ever happened in their life that affects their health. It's very demoralizing.
Sure.
And then you go to a defense doctor because the court rules require allow the defense to take defense medical examinations, right? And then they get this scathing report how they're either exaggerating, faking, or that everything was pre-existing, right? We see that all the time.
The big coincidence theory, I call it.
Yeah.
It's all just one big coincidence.
They have a sprain and strain for 6 to 8 weeks, and that should be it. And then all of a sudden, the coincidence happens. The pain's still there.
Right.
So, you know, I feel that, you know, fighting the good fight is the more important thing for most of my clients. I mean, the money there at the end obviously can change their life if it's significant enough. But even on the smaller cases, like you said, the ones that are not catastrophic, people want to be validated.
Sure.
They know what they've been through. But once they start the claims process with the insurance companies, it seems like the claim adjusters are treating them like crap.
Right.
They're demoralizing them, telling them they're not worth anything. And then at some point, they decided to lawyer up, which is probably a better decision to do earlier than later. And then hopefully they have a good lawyer, like somebody at our firms that actually goes to bat with them. Because some lawyers just don't care like we do.
Right.
Have you seen that? Practice?
Seen it a ton.
Yeah.
Seen it a ton. You know, you'll read an article about a certain settlement amount, and then you'll read the facts. And I often say to myself, well, they should have got double. I often will say, I'm surprised that this firm is bragging about this result when the facts dictate that it was actually not a good result.
Yeah.
And that's why, again, trust is so important. The clients need to rely on our expertise.
Yeah.
And, you had mentioned before, you know, turning down a seven-figure offer. And I'm sure that in order for your client to do that, he or she had to trust you.
Yeah.
Because that's all that there is. They are relying on us. And that's why it's such a heavy burden for us to take everything seriously.
And people don't know this until they have had been in an accident, but there's no price tag on certain injuries.
Right?
It's not like a used car where there's a market for it and you can go look at past sales.
No.
Insurance companies keep that stuff confidential. And lawyers have their own settlements in their own books, but there's no public repository for a broken arm or a shoulder tear or something like that. And oftentimes, pre-litigation, we don't even know how much insurance the other side has.
Right.
So we're really playing a game, a negotiation game, a chess game, shall we say, to try to figure out how much insurance coverage is available. That's even pre-lit. But advising that client throughout the way, and historically it's been by experience and feel of the lawyer.
Absolutely.
And that's all great, but now we have some new technologies coming in with AI, and you know, we all have done focus groups and things like that, which we bring in other people to look at the case before it goes to trial. But I think us using more of these technologies in the future will actually hone in on where the value may be in that particular venue.
I agree. I think it will hone in, and I think that, you know, verdict research is very valuable. But I also think what makes a good lawyer great is understanding that a torn rotator cuff for Mr. Smith is different than a torn rotator cuff for Mr. Jones.
Yeah.
And I think the person makes the claim.
Yep.
And I think that's something that's often lost on these calculations that insurance companies may do when they throw in numbers of medical bills and they throw in the injury and they throw in the age. Well, they're not differentiating the people. And again, that's why it's so important for us to get to know our clients.
Yeah, because they don't know the client's story.
That's a great point.
We focus that on here because, you know, you could talk about it. The defense loves to argue whether it's a disc herniation or a disc bulge. Like, jurors don't either know or care
what
the difference is. What do we believe the plaintiff, which is the most important thing, right? And what's this plaintiff's story? What is he or she going through? Or what have they gone through? You know, I'm going through a negotiation right now where I have a woman in her 60s, late 60s, I believe now, that has a shoulder tear, as you mentioned it, right? Did not have surgery, but she couldn't have surgery because the last 7 years, 10 years, she's been taking care of her husband who got dementia in his 50s, and he needed around-the-clock care. So She went out to the soup. She had aides before COVID to come to the house like every 2 hours, like 2 hours a day, where she can go out and go grocery shopping. Well, that day she went out grocery shopping. Somebody T-boned her, flipped her upside down. She was caught up in the seatbelt upside down and had to, like, release herself. And, of course, she tore her shoulder. Well, for the next 2 years going through COVID, she didn't have those aides because nobody came out to the house. And she couldn't get all the treatment she wanted. She couldn't get the surgery she wanted. And now, unfortunately, he passed away. And we got most of the third-party policy, the person who hit her policy. But she didn't want to litigate because her husband was in really bad shape when we were resolving the case, and we had a statute of limitations, and she didn't want to litigate because she didn't have the time or energy or effort. So we didn't settle for full policy limits, but we got most of it. And now I have a UIM adjuster calling me on the phone saying, you know what, she didn't settle for full policy limits. I don't think anything applies here. So
right.
We're in the middle of that negotiation now. So hopefully when this thing airs in a few weeks, we'll have a resolution to the case. Yeah. But it's like, come on. But it goes back to it. I didn't get yet to tell him her story.
Right.
We did it in a demand package, which I have a feeling half the adjusters don't read impact on life sections and demand packages. Sometimes they do. But and it, I don't know if it's a younger guy or an older guy, but if the her story's properly told, we should be able to get a lot more money on that case. Whether it's to the jury, I don't know that she wants to litigate, but you know, an adjuster has to understand, like, the reason she settled for less than policy limits is her husband was declining, and she had to provide more and more care. And that just wasn't her priority at the time.
Right.
She just wanted it over with. And now he did pass away. Now we have an underinsured claim, and the adjuster doesn't feel it yet. So I have to make him feel that story.
And clearly you know the ins and outs of the case, and that's why you'll get a favorable result. I mean, that was a perfect example of not only on the defense side, but there are a lot of plaintiff's lawyers that do what we do that don't have the background that you just explained.
Yeah.
You know, you having clearly been in contact with this client, you feel and you understand what she's going through,
yeah,
which allows you to tell her story. Whereas if you're just at a mill where people are pushing paper,
yep,
they're going to submit the package based upon medical treatment.
The injuries.
Yep. The injuries. And that's what the defense wants you to do. They want to look at this as a rotator cuff tear with no surgery.
Because that's how the insurance companies do it.
Absolutely.
And we know they have these sophisticated programs, computer programs that value injuries. And what are they valued on? They're valued on probably crappy lawyers getting crappy settlements, not that's guys right. like us that push the case.
Right.
Historically, maybe some firms that don't even do personal injury law. It says, oh, you know, I got a good settlement for something, and it's just like we would look at it and say, that's a third of what we would have got, right?
Exactly right.
So they have all this bad historical data in their system, which unfortunately affects us settling it. But since we're litigating firms, we're going to say, client, we don't think this is fair. We're right. going to fight for you to the end. You have to tell us what you want to do.
Right.
If you want to litigate, we're ready to litigate. And, okay, let's litigate. And then we get fair value, 4 or 5 times what that offer was, if not more.
Right.
And if they still don't come to the table, we have trial. That's what this country is about.
And that's why choosing a lawyer is so important.
Yeah.
Choosing the right
from
lawyer.
Day one.
From day one.
Yeah.
It's, again, not to just hop on somebody's website and to check out what numbers they're putting there, but to meet the lawyer, to sit down with the lawyer, and to say to yourself, is this lawyer going to take it to the end if need be?
Yeah.
And I think that should be the
litmus. So how should people find lawyers? I mean, in today's world, you know, there's experience, which should be on the lawyer's website, right? But we have so many client reviews out there, which I think are good.
Agreed.
But they don't tell the whole package, right? Because I know there's law firms across the country that are just marketing law firms. They don't even handle cases, but somehow they have thousands of reviews.
Right.
And they don't even handle the cases. So reviews are not ethically allowed to be faked or added in our business. And, you know, we could call out lawyers for doing that with the ethics committee. But so reviews are good because I know all of our reviews are real. And we don't pay for reviews. They're real clients, people that we've touched. And I'm sure your firm's is too.
Yep.
But if you read through those reviews, you'll kind of get the feeling of the way the firm works, our mission statement, the way we treat clients. And, you know, but you have to combine that with a little bit more. You have to look at the lawyer's experience, know what they've been through, kind of figure out what battles they've been through.
Right.
I think before choosing a lawyer. Do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think you're exactly right. I think that, you know, the settlement listings are one thing, but to find the verdicts are entirely different. Because if you find a firm like ours that have fought the battles and won the cases and gotten verdicts,
yeah,
that means that a trial took place. It went all the way, and then it was a favorable outcome. But, but I also think that people need to understand that they have the right to reach out to multiple lawyers. And, you know, we always assume in our line of work that if somebody gets catastrophically injured, they know someone.
Yeah.
When unfortunately, that's not always the case.
No.
So obviously, word of mouth and, you know, someone that you trust can say, I actually know this individual. Maybe it's from your community or maybe it's from a prior client. I think that's very important. But I also think that there's nothing to prevent someone from saying, you know what, I'm going to look at this local firm and I'm going to go meet with them and I'm going to show up at their office and I'm going to see who's there.
Are they real?
Are they real?
Do they sound like they know what they're talking
about?
Is
Mike Sale of Cordisco & Sale, the one that I see on the website, is he the one who I'm going to speak with? And is he going to take the time to meet with me? And if the answer is no, he's not going to take the time to meet with you, then he's probably not going to take the time to fight for you.
Yeah, he probably doesn't care about the case.
You may not even know about the case. So I think that, you know, with the smoke and mirrors online these days, you need to do your due diligence because it is a significant choice.
Most people don't even know. That's the problem. Like they say, what, 20 to 30% of people online looking for a lawyer choose the first listing,
exactly,
which is probably
right.
Pay-per-click,
right,
which is probably one of these big national firms or big advertising firms that are not known to be, not all of them are known to be litigators or people that take it or have the values that we do. As a small or medium-sized firm, what we do and what we've talked about on this podcast, I can't say all the lawyers I know are like us.
Agreed.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I think that feel and actually having a contact somewhere is the most important.
Yeah. Well, that's some great advice, and thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Mike.
This was a great conversation.
Appreciate it.
And maybe we'll have you back someday and tell a war story.
About happy to come back anytime.
Your next case and how you fought it to the end and whether it was a good result or bad result, I'm sure that client would be happy.
I look forward to it, Mike.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy. Good to see you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Injury Pros Podcast. If you or someone you know needs a lawyer who's ready to go to trial, make sure you subscribe and share. You can download this episode on your favorite podcast platform or watch the full interview at youtube.com. To learn more, visit injurypros.com.